Accession number 30025, reel 6.
And deploying, they jump out and they get the stretcher?
No. They'll take normally a trauma bag with them and oxygen. And they may take, depending on if they know what the what the casualty is about, they may take the CTT monitor. It's a lot of kit and heavy. So obviously initially they need the trauma bag, which is a great big orange bag, and the air, and they'll take that with them straight away. That's their normally. Then they'll go on back to back on the radio. It's going back to back. I've got a handheld radio. I've also got a radio in the aircraft, and we just put a back to back, which is channel 8, I think it is, on the handheld, and it's channel 12 on the aircraft one. And they can talk to me direct then. And I'll close down. By the time I close the aircraft down, I'm on the handheld radio, and I'll just wait at the aircraft. They will then say to me, "Oh, we need the stretcher out," or they'll need a splints. So they'll ask me whatever equipment's still in the aircraft to bring down to them. And if it's in me, I'll walk down with the kit. Also, if we need the I'm trying to think of the name of it. Actually, the black bag. When we support them on a board, they obviously need the head locks in, and which is ours is fitted with radios. The ground handlers are not, so we can speak to the patient if you're on the board. So I'll take any extra additional equipment down to the scene, or the stretcher down to them, or whatever. They'll just give me a call. At the same time, I'm obviously securing the aircraft. Keeping people away from it. No, I mean, not literally, but if you get too many people in certain areas, you it's a bit of a nightmare. There's a lot of equipment on the aircraft, obviously you don't want to go walk about. But I will try and entertain people, not entertain them on sort of a sideshow, but speak to them, show them around the aircraft if I'm not required on the scene or not quite get equipment down. The other thing is I'll get involved with is obviously... if there's no police on scene, then we go to RTC, it's controlling traffic, make sure the safety of our guys on the ground, which can become a nightmare.
What does that involve?
Traffic control. I'll have visibility jacket and I'll get out then and I'll help them with controlling traffic to get past or stopping it. You get a lot of people and you get the rubberneckers and all the rest of it, and it's just a nightmare. And a lot of people just have total disregard. They'll still go past an ambulance and a fire engine that walk back to 8 with a big, you know. So normally if there's fire engine involved, they normally block the road off straight away, they just dump and that's it, we're all right. But if there's no fire engine, no police on scene, it can be difficult for us at times, and trying to keep ABFNs away, which is a nightmare for us.
Sorry, the ABFNs.
I can't say that. Able-bodied fucking nuisances. Sorry. It's people who come up, they want to do their best, they want to help you out, but they become a nuisance because they get too involved, they just get in the way, and you're just trying to keep them out of the way. And same as with the aircraft, you know, there's lots of people around, and they may know a little bit of knowledge about something, and they just really get in the way. And although they're trying their hardest, and you know they are, you're just trying to calm them down, keep them away. It's just a nightmare at times. Some of them, they just get too overpowered, and you've got to be a bit stern with them and don't get away. Other people, you know, they know straight away, you know, keep away, we're all right. But, yeah, get a lot of AV events. But every incident and every accident or every situation we're going is obviously different, and that's the thing about flying the air ambulance. You don't know what you're going to, don't know where your landing site's going to be. It's very rare that we've got the same saying that up into half as an occasion. I've been exactly the same spot because it's like an accident, black zone, or there's certain stables where I go to quite frequently because of people falling off the shows and stuff. Fast tracks. One of the tracks down near New Market, there's always somebody coming from motorbike to one of these tracks. We could go there quite a lot. So we've got various areas we go to on a frequent basis. But you normally don't know what site you're going to, what to expect, you know, what type of landing site. And it's just going through your mind. And so what happens is if we get a call and they say, right, you're going, especially in our room down at Hollington, they will say we're going off to whatever village or town. I will run out the aircraft. The paramedics will then be getting finer details, a good reference if they can, obviously information on the casualty they're going to, all the rest of it. By this stage I'm outside and the aircraft started up. They'll come running out, jump in, secure. I will then get them to wherever they're going to, i.e. if they say it's North Walsham or it's Hunstanton, Felixstowe, I will get in the right direction. So within seconds of them getting in the aircraft and securing themselves, we're off in the right direction. We'll then fine tune it. We'll then say, right, where are we going to exactly? Because they will obviously the major town they're going towards. We'll then get the 50,000 map out or the map book out and then start fine tuning down to where we're going to actually go for the, to the casualty. So my job is to get them there. I will get them there as quick as I can. And we're talking to each other all the time, bearing in mind we're still getting information coming through from control, giving us updates on the casualty. And if we stood down, for instance, we'd get called and get halfway there and say, there's somebody on scene, you're not required, so we'll go back. But all we're trying to do en route is obviously fine-tune the navigation, as much detail as possible we can on the patient, and then decide on, as even before we get there, right, this is what we're going to do. The plan is we'll get on site, we'll do this, we'll do that. It sounds like it sounds like that. It may be a head injury. We'll probably go to Arnabrooks down in Cambridge, or it may be it's plastic, so we're going to go end and end. Or it's burns, major burns, so we'll go down to Essex. You know, that's what's been decided. If the patient's not stable, for instance, although it may be an Allenbrook casualty because it may dread injury, but if he's not stable, then he goes to the nearest A&E. That's what we do. Get the patient stable. We may never see them again, and they'll get transported down later on. But we may transport them ourselves at later time in the day. But it's decisions like that coming through all the time, and we're trying to work out a provisional plan. Nine out of ten, it changes because we don't know what we expect when we get there. But that's our thing: is to get a provisional plan going and try and stick to it best we can. And then obviously, every situation has got to be assessed when we're on scene. You see some horrible sights, you see some pretty entertaining sights and amusing. I mean, I don't mean that laughing at somebody that's injured, but I mean the situations.
In what way?
Well, somebody's done something to themselves and it's just an amusing way they've done it, you know, for it, you know, I could give you an example. It's not funny, but we went to a location where a person severed his fingers, most of his fingers. I'm not laughing at that, I wouldn't laugh at that at all, but it's just the fact that I was given a bowl with all these fingers in it. You know, I said, oh, can you look after them, right? And I just turned around. I think that was probably my first month or something. And they gave me this bowl, and there were all these fingers in it. I looked at these fingers, like, okay, this doesn't bother me. But they were nice and all that. I said, put them down here, I look after them fingers, so I look after this guy's fingers. Then we got on the aircraft, and he said, oh, we're going to go for so and such because it's a better hospital for this particular injury, blah, blah, blah. And apparently, I said, I've got to hand it to you, very calm. And, you know, and I was just laughing because of the way things were said, you know, and it was just. Yeah.
It's black humour, isn't it?
Yeah, it was just things like that. And I think it. Wasn't the case? It's a sign for something, and he's going, "Oh, you can't, can you?" You know, things like that. These little things. I mean, it's not sick. I mean, it's just.
It's black humour. It's when you're in a very extreme
situation.
Yeah,
but the patient, it was very good as well, because he knew what was going on, you know, and it was good. But sometimes you go to an instance and it's not very nice, and it doesn't bother me whatsoever. I mean, I don't mind. I'm sort of sick of, but I'm not. If there's somebody very seriously injured, and you know, open wounds or whatever, it doesn't bother me. Which I'm chuffed to bits because if it did, if it affected me, then I wouldn't be doing the job. But I can go to and see all sorts of gory, horrible bits and pieces, and that didn't bother me. And I'll probably criticise the job now because the children's different. The kids involved, it does get you a bit more, you know. But you've got to blank it out, you know, and just get on the job. Because if you start getting too sort of emotional or involved, you've got to fly the aircraft to the hospital and all the rest of it. The other thing is when you've got somebody on board who is, you know, life critical, we've got to get in there. You can't start cutting corners. Oh, I'll just take off quickly, or I'll wazz it here, and I'll pull all this. And you know, it's a case of being professional about your job. You sit down. You're going to take off the same. You're going to fly the same. The aircraft's not going to go any faster because you're, you know, twitching or bumping up and down or going, say, come on faster. It's just going to go at one speed and one speed only, and you can't do anything about it. That's where you've got to discipline yourself in your own mind, not to get too involved in the fact that if you don't get him to hospital in you know, minutes, he's going to die. It's a fact that you're going to get him to hospital as fast as you possibly can anyway, regardless. And it doesn't matter how quickly you speak on the radio or how you know, you can't pull the aircraft any faster. You just got to get that out of the way and just fly. And that, things like that, you know, those people, oh God, I can't believe it. Oh, he's going to die. We're going to get in there as quickly as possible. Sorry, you know, I'll get in there as quickly as I can. You know, and regardless of what condition the patient is, the aircraft goes at one speed and one speed only. You know, you pull it up to a certain limit and you can't make it go any faster. It just goes. And that's how I think of it. And I'm glad I do that way, because I'm not flapping. I'm not going to start doing stupid things to get away. I mean, yeah, we'll a little bit urgency in closing doors and getting started, but I mean, there's nothing else. You just got to get it out of your mind. You're trying to get that patient to hospital as fast as possible, anyway, without causing any more injuries to anybody.
So where is the patient actually?
In the 117, it's great because I can't see anything. The cabin and the cockpit's blanked off almost. So I've got a nice big cockpit in front, and we've got a separation between us, and the patient in the back. I can hear everything that's going on, because I can also isolate, I can switch them off if there's screaming and shouting going on, which there could be. You've got a noisy patient, just turn it down or turn them off completely and isolate them. And I've got a little flashing light. If the paramedic wants to speak to me, I dislike flashes, so I can switch it back on. So I can switch everything off in the back, so I can only listen to air traffic control and crack on with my job. They get on with their job. But if they need to speak to me quick, say they have to land or something because they need to do something with the patient, need, you know, better access or something, then I'd have to land. They'll just alert me by this flashing light. So I can isolate them, so I don't have to have them screaming and shouting at me as well. But I can't see the patient. In the 115, the patient's there, you can see the patient. The paramedic is in the front seat, the seat's turned round and facing backwards. You know, it's all because it's a smaller cabin and cockpit and everything, so it's different. But on the 117, patient in the back, I don't see him until we get the hospital and open the doors.
So you get to hospital. Where are you landing in hospital?
Well, it's at Great Yarmouth. We've got a nice big helipad at the JPH, but it's almost a secondary transfer. You're not right outside the A&E. At NNN, Norfolk and Norwich, you're right outside the A&E. Nice big designed helicopter landing site. And now, in the new aircraft, we've got our own trolley, so we just pull it straight out of the back and wheel them straight in. At King's Lynn, we land on a bit of grass, which is 50 or so metres from the A&E. But there's no footpath, there's not a designed helipad, it's just a bit of grass. In fact, the pad we're landing on at the moment is being sold, the bit of land. They are going to give us another new pad in King's Lynn eventually, but when, we don't know. Down at Huntington, you land in the police headquarters, and it's a secondary transfer. Peterborough, you land in the Butterfly Hotel, another secondary transfer. You've got Allenbrooks, you land in the Gogs Golf Course, and that's a secondary transfer, they come down to you. We've got a nice landing site inside the West Suffolk Hospital at Bury. We land in the football pitch at the school adjacent to the hospital in Ipswich. We've got gates that need to be opened, two sets of gates to get out of there. We have had two occasions where we've been stood behind the gate waiting for them to open the gate, but non-critical casualties, just a bit of communication problems there. But I've never had, every time I went in with somebody serious, they've always been open, somebody's been there, but I've had a couple of times where it hasn't. But yeah, it's all the hospital, the major hospitals we use. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five of them are secondary transfer, which is a bit annoying. We should have landing sites right outside. Colchester, that's right outside as well. We're going to Colchester when we go down into Essex.
And what happens when you land, and what happens?
Right, if it's a non-major serious casualty, we land on, I close down within about 30 seconds, a minute, it's all closed down and we're out. Back doors are open, the big clamshell doors, patient's out, pulled straight on the stretcher, and we just wheel them into A&E or to the reception. If it's a very serious casualty, we normally met by the team from A&E, and they'll just wait at the side, the paramedic will jump out, I'll close the aircraft down, and as soon as the ropes are stopped, they're in, we've got the patient out, and then they start doing the handover and talking through what's happened to the casualty, you know, the age, what's happened, all the rest of it, on the way in, and they're getting briefed as soon as, and obviously quite speedy going in with a casualty, so the team's getting briefed as they go in.
And you're helping with the stretcher?
Yeah, I don't lift. Oh, I do lift now and then, but not heavy stuff. I'm not allowed to. That's what they say. But I do help when I can. But anything else, I will them in. Apparently, mind we may be carrying a monitor that the guy's on, oxygen, if we can't put it on the actual stretcher itself. So there's three of us, and we're normally quite busy carrying bits and pieces or guiding the trolley. I just normally grab all the front end of it, and the paramedics will be doing the patient. All I'll be doing is steering it into the various A&Es. And then once they're in A&E, that's my job. Then I go outside and chill out while they do the handover of the patient, and go back in every now and then and collect a bit of kit that we've got that's gone in there. And that's the same as on the scene. I will watch our kit, watch our equipment, because if you go to some of these incidents, and a couple of ambulances, there's a responder, there's an officer on the scene, they've all got their bags, they've all got their trauma bags, they've all got oxygen, and we've got to look after our own kit. So my job, or one of my jobs, is just watch where our kit is, try and keep it to one side. I also watch the clock, and I'll shout to the paramedics on how long I've been on scene, because time on scene is obviously crucial, especially if it's a trapped patient, somebody in a trapped car, can't be there trapped too long. And all I will show, being on scene 20 minutes or 10 minutes, and keep the time going. I also watch, if they've got CDs, the oxygen bottles on a patient, I'll watch, see how long it's been on. They'll be watching it itself, but I'm just as a reminder, if they've got fluids on the guy, I'll watch the fluid bag. Because you'll see a fireman stood there and he's been given a fluid bag to hold. It's just empty and you need some fluid, so they're putting the fluid bag on, or the oxygen's running out. So I'll keep an eye on that. It's something I do. It's some of the teams gel, and we I gel with the paramedics, and it's just something I do. I'll watch the clock, because if you've been on scene 40 minutes, the bloke's still trapped. That's getting pretty poor. You need to get him out. So I just remind them the timings and watch the bits and pieces and get the kit. And if there's anything they've finished with, I know they finished with, I'll get them back the aircraft out of the way, because there's nothing worse than having kit sprung all over the place, and also losing kit, which is another thing. Just a bit of personal pride being on that side. We may get to A&E's and they may say, well, for instance, we've got the other week, dropped off a guy and stabilised him, and they say he's got to go to Allenbrook, so we then take him on to Allenbrook Hospital. We've done that a couple of times at King's Lynn with people. But then you lose, remember, one of your crew, because they may have an anaesthetist have to go along on the aircraft, so we may have to lose a crew. But in the new aircraft, it's not a problem, because we can just put them in the back. There's enough seating in the back for extra people. But on the old one, nightmare.
So can you give me a sketch of the new one? You said it was a 117?
BK 117, yeah. It's a big brother of the old one, which is the Bulker 105. Bulker 105, you've got pilot, paramedic, and behind you you've got one seat facing sideways, and that's the paramedic, and then the stretcher. It's very small. You've got a very low cabin, so the patient comes up a tube sort of thing almost, and comes out about yay far. So you can't really attend anything down the legs or the abdomen. You've only got the chest and the head sort of thing in front of you in the old one. In the new one, we've got a high cabin, so you can get all the way down the patient. There's one, two, three, four sitting positions in the back, as well as a prone casualty. And we've also got paramedic up front with me. So the good thing about it, if we take if we took a child in the old one, we can't take a parent. In the new one, we can take a parent, which is great. You've got to think about when you're taking a relative. First of all, severity of the injuries of the person you're carrying. And the reason I say that, if they possibility they may go into some sort of convulsion or whatever, you've not only got the patient to look after, it's probably a very, very upset parent. You can't fight the parent if you're trying to look after the child, or, you know, it's all got to be thought about. And the paramedics don't just willy-nilly say, well, we'll take the mum and dad and all, we'll take the parent and mum. They think about it before and say, well, hang on a minute. Quick discussion to one side. Is this child going to throw a wobbler? Is he going to, you know, go into any, you know, okay, we'll leave or whatever. I won't take anybody up front because they'd say, oh, could you sit them in the front? No way. I'm not having somebody throwing a wobbler with me up front, you know. If they've got a screaming kid down the back and they want to get that child, you've got a parent who you cannot predict what's going to happen and what they're going to do. So that's what I always think about and say, well, hang on a minute, no. So I don't particularly care. If you can't get him in the back, I don't like him going up front. Unless it's a stabilised casualty, and you say it's assessing the situation at the time, and you say, well, that person is unconscious, they're not going to wake up, fine. This person, you're unhappy, you assess them at the time, and he has to be a thumb before, you know, epileptic and all that stuff, because you know, some of the doing breakdowns in the left hand seat when you're trying to get him to hospital, you know what I mean?
You really don't.
No. So everything's done on the hoof. Everything's, you're always moving, and your decisions are seconds. You can't start sort of, you know, having a big discussion about things. It's got to be instant, it's got to be quick, it's got to be accurate, it's got to be best thing for everybody, you know. And that's how we sort of crack on in the air ambulance.
What's the 117 like to fly?
It's a lovely aircraft to fly. I mean, it's about 130, 140 knots, which is about 150, 160 miles an hour. And the older one, 120 knots, so it's a bit slower. But the new one is full IFR, so it's full instrument flying rated, so we can transfer at night. Single pilot, it's got an autopilot on it, so you can let go of the controls if you engage the autopilot. So it gives you time to sort out maps or whatever if you're flying along. It is lovely aircraft flying, it's got more power, so you're not going to get caught out being stuck to get in and out of a tight area. It's normally capable of getting in and out without any problem of fuel monitoring. In the old one, you need to monitor the fuel critically because of that, but in the new one, you don't need to. Well, you do, but not to that extent. It's only when you take off in the morning, if you go straight to a job and you're full of fuel, or a short distance to a job, then you maybe have to watch it. But this time of year, with the temperatures down, it's very good. Summer, higher temperatures, less power in the engines because of the temperatures, and that's where you start worrying, because obviously the temperature of the engines go up, you lose power because of the lack of oxygen, thinness of the air, all the rest of it, and the hot temperature. And that's when you've got to watch out. But 117 is a lovely machine. It's probably the best air ambulance in the country, I would say. And we're getting another one shortly, so it's good.
Okay, so we were talking about the sort of characteristics of the 117. I'm just trying to think, as compared to the other aircraft you've flown. I just wondered, how does this roll compare to what you were doing before? Because there are obviously some areas of crossover, and then there are things that are very, very different.
Yeah. I think being an ex-military pilot is probably a really, really good thing for me as an air ambulance pilot. The reason I say that is because I'm used to flying at low level. I'm used to going into tight situations and quick, slick, and obviously safety. I think personally, it must be difficult for a civilian who hasn't got a military background, who's probably just gone and flown commercial type of flying, like A to B, trips around the bay, the odd charter, and then gets himself onto an air ambulance role. Bearing in mind, like I've said previously, finding a landing spot in the middle of a town, middle of woods, villages, industrial sites, you know, it probably be a little bit difficult for them, and they'll be thinking more of the bigger scale, i.e. the bigger landing sites. You know, oh, can I get in there? Have I got the performance? All the rest of it. I can understand that, but and they will, you know, they will eventually get used to getting in and out. But it probably is a bit difficult for them. But it hasn't been as difficult for me to convert from a military background to a civilian background, and especially on this type of flying with air ambulance. And it has done me in good stead being a military pilot previously.
What's the toughest landing you've ever done?
On air ambulance.
Yeah, I was just saying, you were talking about the idea that it sounded as if you being able to be slightly more manoeuvrable was actually very useful.
Well, no, I mean, it's just like, for instance, I went into a very, very small site down in Lowestoft, and it was near the docks, but although it's a vast area, the docks, the safest area would have been miles away from where the casualty was, and there was quite a tight little landing site for me to get into. I obviously got in, it was not a problem, but it's just the fact that somebody else may land miles away, and you think, well, these guys have got to get that casualty, they've got to do the rest of it. But, and as long as the aircraft's not in danger, as long as I'm not in danger and other people are not in danger, then fine, I will go into tight sites. But, you know, I landed on a bridle path next to the canal, which is only very narrow, just enough to get the skids on. There's obviously the water one side, and you've got a bit of an embankment on the other side. So, you know, things like that you've got to get onto. And you've got to remember the width of your skids. You've got to remember the diameter of your rotor blades to get in and out. Bearing in mind that the minimum landing site for us is 15 metres by 15 metres. That's a cleared landing site. That's so we get in quite safely. It's quite small, though, 15 metres by 15 metres. That's for a helipad area. We haven't got facilities of people marking out 15 by 15 or whatever. We've just got to assess it quickly. Can we get in? You may have to even do a dummy approach, an overshoot, just to have a quick look at it and say, oh no, I can get in. And then all of a sudden, when you get down to it, you can't get in and say, no, I'm not. And you've got to get, you're crying early, no, I'm overshooting, going around and find somewhere else. So there's, I've said earlier about deciding on the hoop and deciding on the feet, on your feet. You it's something that's got to be done quickly. Assessing a decent site to land in, with the big safety in mind. I keep saying safety because it's one of my major things. Is safety. The military side, yeah, it did me good stuff for this job.
What safety procedures do you have?
What respect?
I just wondered, in the event of fire, things like that, or extraordinary situations, have you got processes?
Oh yeah, we've got full drills for every eventuality. We've got drills that we've got to follow, and we've got a thing called flip cards, which are inside the aircraft. You've also got emergencies. You've got to memorise that without referring to the cards. So you've got instant actions, memoried actions, and then you've got actions that you memorise the first sort of three actions, and the rest you can, if you don't know them, is get the flip cards out and look through them. And the paramedic, if he's a left hand seat, he will go through the cards with you.
So can you talk me through a couple of memoried actions?
Well, for instance, if you had a fire in flight, obviously you'd get a caption saying you've got a fire. So you, first of all, is you look, I have got a fire, you've got to identify which engine's on fire. So first of all, identify the engine, it's number one engine. I tell the crew straight away and the packs, we've got a fire number one engine. My first thing is to then verify it's the correct engine. And there's a firearm button I switch up. That immediately cuts off the fuel to the engine and closes the engine down. It also arms the fire bottle to tell me that I'm going to put a fire bottle down the number one engine or number two engine. That's immediate actions on that one. Identify the power lever comes back. You then select the button that's appropriate to that engine. So you press the button and it wangs down a fireball down in that engine bay. You then start the clock and wait for a minute. Because you wait, for a minute. Because if it doesn't go out, you've got to press number two fireball and it goes down the same engine. Because once you've selected that particular side, there's a bottle at each side, and they will just fire down the bay that you've selected.